This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa. JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharisa, the editor-in-chief over at numberfire.com, and this is episode 19 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the Number Fire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. This is a big week in the fantasy football industry. Scott Fish sent out invites to his famous Scott Fish Bowl, which this year will have 420 analysts and 180 fans competing in 60 different fantasy football leagues. It's an amazing giant league that brings together the industry like almost nothing else, and it allows fantasy football fans, so not the writers, to compete against some of their favorite analysts. And the best part is that each year, Scott improves the league's structure and scoring. He's always tinkering with ways to make it better. It's a super flex league with all sorts of flex spots, but the scoring always makes you think. For instance, this year, you're getting no points per reception, but a point per first down rushing and receiving. And that brings me to the first question of this week's mailbag episode. This is from @SmithBK. Thoughts on your hashtag SFB7 division and strategy for the new scoring settings. So regarding the division, all of them are going to be tough. You're talking about the best analysts in the game and fans who are just as good of players as anyone. That's what makes this league so fun. It's super competitive and it's super difficult. As for the strategy, I think I gave some of this away on the supply and demand podcast that I did last week. But like most years, I'm still waiting for my QB despite it being a super flex league. Because in this league, you're starting 3 wide receivers, 2 running backs, and 3 additional flex spots. As for the first down wrinkle, I think that it will or should make us favor running backs a bit more, as the top players in first downs last year were running backs. And with no PPR, running backs become more valuable for those flex spots. So it wouldn't be shocking if I went with a later round quarterback strategy, running back heavy approach in this draft. We'll see though. My thoughts might change as we get close to draft time, which is early to mid-July. This next question is an email from Andy. He says, JJ, I've heard you reference a boomerang effect for quarterback touchdown rates using recent outlier seasons by Cam Newton and Andy Dalton as examples. I understand the concept that after a season either significantly above or below the average touchdown rate, there's almost certainly going to be regression to the mean. I could be mistaken, but it seems like you've suggested more than that. That after an outlier season in one direction, it's likely that the next season, the QB will not just return to an average touchdown rate, but will actually have a rate on the other side of that average rate, i.e. the proverbial boomerang. Can you clarify if that's what you or the data is suggesting? Thanks, Andy. So when I mention the boomerang thing, all I really mean is that one year a player's touchdown rate will be X, the next it will be Y, and that Y is more than likely going to be at the player's mean within the statistic. I'm just talking about regression. With that being said, the reason it may be interpreted as me saying this dude is going to blow up is because ADP generally reflects the previous season for a lot of these players. So let's take Andy Dalton, for instance. He'll be drafted as a mid QB2 after scoring 18 touchdowns last year through the air. He had a 3.2% touchdown rate. Had he finished the year with a typical 4.6% touchdown rate, which is his career average, he would have had almost 26 touchdowns, which is 32 more points than he actually finished with. 32 more points from Andy Dalton last year would have resulted in a QB6 finish. Andy Dalton would have been a high-end QB1. I've probably mentioned overcorrection, and I mostly say it because I'm not shocked by it happening in a game with small sample sizes. But basically, what I'm saying is that regressing to a player's mean is a more likely scenario than overcorrecting to get to said mean, which is what I think your question is asking. When I do talk about the boomerang effect, I just am trying to put regression into simple terms for people. It's a really, really great question though, and I'm sorry if I didn't explain that thoroughly enough before. This next question is from Twitter. It's from @HelloQuinny. I hear a lot of talk about efficiency, but how do you measure efficiency? Probably not as easy as points per target slash touch. So that's part of the problem when talking about efficiency. There's no uniform, obvious way to define it. Generally speaking though, a highly efficient player in one category will be highly efficient in another. If a dude, let's say, is good in yards per target, then he'll probably be okay enough in fantasy points per target or even reception net expected points per target, which is what we use at NumberFire. But the way I think of efficiency at a high level, bird's eye view in fantasy football, is by looking at it in conjunction with volume. High efficiency and low volume in fantasy football doesn't mean a whole lot. That's what you get out of that deep threat role at times with New Orleans. What Devery Henderson was in New Orleans back in the day. Or what Taylor Gabriel was for the Falcons last year. Sure, those players will have big days because they're uber efficient with their touches. But because of their low volume, it's not helping you much in fantasy. And then you have low efficiency with high volume. Terrell Pryor last year comes to mind. Frank Gore over the last, 5 years of his career is a not so efficient, high volume running back. And there's nothing wrong with that. Frank Gore has still been usable in fantasy football because volume drives fantasy football. And then you get the unicorns who have high efficiency and high volume. The stud running backs, the stud wide receivers, and so on. So when we talk about efficiency, we're really looking at things in that way. Pryor's actually a pretty good example because he's going from being a pretty inefficient wide receiver where he had 140 targets and just 4 touchdowns last year to a team where every relevant wide receiver was better last season in terms of fantasy points per target. So even with a decrease in volume for Pryor, an increase in efficiency will help him remain super relevant in fantasy football. And if he sees the same amount of volume, which I get is unlikely, then he could really blow up. So to answer your question, there's no single metric that measures efficiency for positions across the board. The word is thrown around to just describe how these players are accumulating yards, touchdowns, and in turn, fantasy points. This next question is from @BroncosFan_13. Fantasy leagues are won in large part with lucky late round off the radar selections. Who are some of those guys? Any trends? So I wanted to answer and talk about this question on the show because I kind of disagree with the question itself. I'm not saying that you're wrong, BroncosFan_13, but if you're playing fantasy football with the idea that you just have to get lucky to win, then you're doing it wrong. Luck plays a factor, there's no doubt, but luck also plays a factor in a lot of things in life. It's probability that we're really working with here, which is a completely different thing than luck. The fact is, the probability of you hitting on a league-winning player in the late rounds is very, very thin. Not only does it not happen as often as people probably think, but you have to be the team that ends up getting that player. But let's look at some late-round players who have really come through for teams over the last 5 or so years. You have Devontae Freeman in 2015. He had an RB38 ADP preseason. Knowshon Moreno in 2013, he was RB53. David Johnson in 2015 was RB47. Josh Gordon in 2013 was wide receiver 35. And of course, Odell Beckham in 2014, who was wide receiver 67. Generally speaking, players who blow up are unknown entities who have some sort of opportunity. This is why I'm totally cool with people drafting Kenny Golladay this year, his rookie season. Do I know for sure that Golladay will be good? No, I don't know that at all. My model really likes him, but I know and you know that successful draft picks are mostly random. So why pick Golladay? Well, there's ambiguity. We don't know what he'll look like on an NFL field. My model seems to think that he's good, like I said, and he should have some immediate opportunity in Detroit's offense, an offense that will throw 3 wide receivers on the field all the time. Kenny Golladay is the de facto third wide receiver on this Lions team. Those guys, to me, are the kinds of players that you want to draft late. And that's another reason why I hate handcuffing. I'll be doing a show on this next week based on an article I recently wrote on Numberfire, but handcuffing is dumb. It's not an upside-driven strategy. It's a floor-driven strategy. And by drafting handcuffs, you're missing out on those late-round educated guesses, those dart throws late, which you're throwing those darts at guys who you think could be good based on very, very slim evidence. Because after all, those guys are being drafted late for a reason. They're not supposed to be good. But if there's one small sliver of hope, then get them. And by drafting a handcuff, you're not capturing that upside. So sure, you can call those late round picks lucky, but there's still a thought process to allow those players to even be drafted in the first place. And it has to do with ambiguity and opportunity. This next one was an email from Evan. He says, JJ, can you rank Amari Cooper, Doug Baldwin, and Dez Bryant this year for redraft? I keep getting stuck deciding between them in my mock drafts. Thanks, Evan. I'll be the first to admit that I hate questions like this because of my thoughts on rankings and variants in fantasy football. But with that being said, it's actually a really good question, Evan. If you're sitting there having to take one of these players, it's not an easy choice at all. I can tell you that my initial projections actually say that Doug Baldwin is the pick. Baldwin, according to my model, again, this isn't Numberfire's algorithm and it's not affiliated with Numberfire at all, But Doug Baldwin, according to my model, is wide receiver 9, Amari Cooper is wide receiver 11, and Dez is wide receiver 12. With that being said, the difference between Baldwin to Dez is 12 PPR points, which is nothing. I think that this depends on what you want out of that pick. Amari Cooper, to me, is the play for the highest ceiling. I've talked about it before on this podcast, but we know the reason that Amari Cooper hasn't ascended into the elite tier of fantasy football wideouts, and it's because of his red zone volume and potentially his red zone ability. Cooper finished 14th in PPR scoring last year at wide receiver despite having zero red zone touchdowns. The next player on the list of wideout rankings who had zero red zone touchdowns was Ted Ginn, who ranked wide receiver 49. Every other wide receiver between Amari Cooper and Ted Ginn had at least one red zone touchdown. In other words, Cooper did a lot of good things despite the fact that he didn't find the end zone in those high leverage situations. Part of the reason he didn't score, like I said, was volume, as he had just 13 targets in the red zone while teammate Michael Crabtree had 22. But as I said before on the podcast, maybe Amari Cooper is just a Julio Jones type. Remember, Julio Jones doesn't get a lot of red zone love either. But here's the upside. Cooper is still just 22 years old. He's turning 23 in a couple of weeks. There's plenty of reason to believe that he can turn the corner and become a more complete wide receiver. And the other point to all this is that he saw just one fewer target than Crabtree from within the opponent's 10-yard line. But Crabtree scored 4 touchdowns on those targets. Cooper, of course, didn't score any. And regression should hit for him too. He didn't see a lot of volume, but it's crazy that he wasn't able to score in the red zone last year. And to people who think that Marshawn Lynch is going to change this dramatically, I don't see that happening. Latavius Murray last year, despite playing only 14 games, was 6th in attempts within the opponent's 5-yard line, 7th within the opponent's 10, and 7th in red zone attempts. Latavius Murray was getting touches last year. I don't think that Marshawn Lynch is all of a sudden going to be the number one guy in red zone attempts. And then with Dez and Doug Baldwin, they really are similar players output-wise, despite the fact that they're two completely different wide receivers. And Dez really soared down the stretch last year with Dak, but Baldwin's a safer play in terms of end-of-year production. But I'll say this about Doug Baldwin. He isn't nearly as consistent as some folks might think. He had only 6 top 24 performances last year in PPR leagues, despite finishing as a top wideout, where guys like Terrell Pryor, DeSean Jackson, Larry Fitzgerald, they all had more top 24 wide receiver 1, wide receiver 2 performances than Doug Baldwin did last year. The reason Doug Baldwin finished where he did was because he had 5 top 10 performances, which really helped buoy his overall production. So I think given how Dez did down the stretch, I'd probably put him above Baldwin. And if you want upside, Cooper is your dude. This next one is from Twitter, @RushSweeney. Who do you see as value picks in the 5th and 6th round based on their ADP? Late round podcast is great. Keep it up. Appreciate that. I'll do my best to keep it up. Questions like these are tough right now, though, because ADP data is just literally all over the place. It's like me watching a playoff hockey game in my living room. I'm just pacing. I can't sit down. My wife doesn't know what I'm doing. I'm all over the place. That's what ADP data is like in late May, early June. But I'll use fantasyadhd.com's MFL10 data to talk about these 5th and 6th round choices. A couple of guys do stand out. The first one is Ty Montgomery. We can say that the Packers added running backs in the draft, which they did in Jamal Williams and Aaron Jones, but Ty Montgomery could still easily see 35-40% of the team's rushing share, which would bring him to a solid 150 or so carries on the ground. And then we know he'll especially be used through the air. He averaged well over 4 targets per game when he was a starter last year, and with a potential double-digit market share there, he could be a nice PPR back for you. Add in the fact that he's in an Aaron Rodgers-led offense, and you've got a good situation for Ty Mont, especially if those other backs just don't pan out. I mean, they were both later round selections. So I like Ty Montgomery. I think he has a lot of upside. I also don't mind Jamison Crowder in the 5th. You know, I've been very, very open about my Terrell Pryor love, but Crowder's a virtual lock for 100 to 110 targets and has even more upside if something were to happen to Jordan Reed, who plays in that same area of the field. Jordan Reed, guys, is one concussion away potentially from having serious, serious issues. Crowder is in line for touchdown regression, but the positives are there, especially if Josh Doctson can't be a thing for Washington this year, because that'll lead to more volume. So I like Jamison Crowder. I think he's a solid pick. I also like Bilal Powell as a late 6th rounder, strictly from a volume standpoint. I hate associating my running backs with bad offenses, and yes, the Jets offense is going to be #very bad this year. But Powell is, at the very least, the third down back in that awful offense with very few effective receiving targets. And I'd expect Powell to see a larger rushing market share in that backfield than he did last year as Matt Forte continues to age. And Matt Forte was very, very ineffective down the stretch. So on a team that should have a negative game scripts often, Powell can realistically and easily reach 50 receptions. He's had 47 and 58 the last 2 years, respectively. But again, he's got real opportunity to see more than his previous career high of 176 rush attempts. Matt Forte is old, he really hit a wall, and despite the touchdown upside, Powell should at least give you a decent enough floor each week in PPR formats. So those are the three that stood out to me. Ty Montgomery, Jamison Crowder, Bilal Powell, and I think you could throw Martavis Bryant in there too. This next one is from @RichLuchin. Your comments about the Panthers' O changing with draft, does this help or hurt Cam? Would you rather have Rivers or Cam as your quarterback this year? Thanks. What's going to help or hurt Cam in the end is his rushing. Cam had that concussion back in week 4 against Atlanta last year. Through the first 3 weeks, he had ranked 10th, 1st, and 19th in quarterback scoring while running the ball 11, 6, and 7 times. He had 2 rushing touchdowns in his first 3 games. Cam averaged 5.8 rushing attempts per game from there on out, down from the 8 that he saw per game over the first 3 games, and he totaled 8 rushing attempts from his opponent's 5-yard line last year. In 2015, that number was 12, which is significantly higher. Cam only had 90 rushing attempts last year, which is easily a career low for him. I just don't think that that's a coincidence. He got crushed at the goal line against Atlanta, and the coaching staff knows that they can't have Cam Newton getting concussed if they want to go the distance. And if you look at what they added in the draft, they added players who can really, really help around the line of scrimmage. Curtis Samuel played running back in college, and while he can potentially stretch the field with his 4.3 speed, we know that he can be a yards after the catch guy. And Christian McCaffrey obviously is a versatile back that can sort of replace some of those highly effective quarterback runs designed for Cam. The main reason Cam regressed last year is because what he did in 2015 just was not sustainable. And I do think this new offense is a smarter direction for the Panthers to go in because it could potentially be more new age and current, giving Cam higher percentage throws while limiting his rushing and allowing him to morph into more of a traditional pocket passer. But that also means the potential for less fantasy scoring because he's not going to have, potentially again, as much rushing. And the other point to make here too is that he's going to be out for a good chunk of the offseason, so learning all of this could be very difficult as well. With that being said, I would still probably take Cam Newton over Rivers just because of the upside. Rivers really wasn't that good last year. Granted, I get it, he didn't have Keenan Allen, but he wasn't that good last year. I love the Chargers. I think the Chargers are going to be the surprise team this year. They're a sneaky, great team. But Rivers finished in the top 12 in weekly scoring a grand total of 3 times last year. He had as many top 24 performances as Matt Ryan, which was the most in the league, and he had the 8th most top 18 performances. But he was 24th in top 12 performances because he lived in that high-end QB2 land all year long. Every week, he was not giving you upside. He was just giving you high-end QB2 performances. I want upside in my quarterback, so give me Cam Newton, because who knows, maybe the offense doesn't drastically change, and maybe they run him like they've run him throughout his career. At least there's some semblance of upside there, and I don't see that same type of upside in a guy like Philip Rivers. The next question is from a dude who clearly does not like this year's running back class. He's @JasonSparra2, and he asked, are people going too crazy about a mediocre rookie running back crop? Aren't these early ADP rankings a bit out of control? I asked him to elaborate if he was talking about McCaffrey, Cook, Mixon, and Fournette, to which he said that he was also referring to Samaje Perine, Marlon Mack, Kareem Hunt, Alvin Kamara, all of those guys as well. And then he said, most of these guys will do next to nothing. Like I said, Jason doesn't seem to like this running back class. I think this sort of plays into what I talked about over and over again prior to the draft, and it's that these situations aren't incredibly clear-cut. Literally, with any of these running backs, there's someone else in the backfield with them taking looks away. But that's just how it is in today's NFL, meaning the reason we're seeing high rookie ADP numbers is because of supply and demand. The demand of running backs is great. It hasn't changed. You're still starting 2 or 3 running backs in your fantasy league, but the supply is limited. And when that's the case, that raises the cost in obtaining them. But you have to tell yourself a story with a lot of these guys. I like Kareem Hunt because Spencer Ware saw a lot of volume for the first time ever last year, and he wasn't as effective than when he was a more of a complement in that backfield. Samaje Perine doesn't really have that much competition. I could see him stepping in and being very fantasy relevant this year. Joe Mixon is going up against an ineffective and seemingly unmotivated Jeremy Hill and a guy coming off an ACL tear in Gio Bernard. Dalvin Cook has to just beat out a guy in Latavius Murray. So there are these stories with these running backs, and you can tell these stories to yourself in order to draft these running backs. It's not that hard to envision Joe Mixon being a super fantasy relevant back this year. And there are just so few really, really good running backs in fantasy football right now that it's forcing us all to perhaps reach half a round or maybe a full round to get these players. I don't think that's really wrong. I really don't. This is supply and demand. This is just what happens in fantasy football. This is just the way that it is. This last one is from Kevin Banks, who's from Atlanta. He says, too long for Twitter. I'm commissioner of a 10-team keeper auction league, standard ESPN lineups and scoring. It's gotten stale. Any suggestions on new wrinkles to spice things up? I want to do something, but don't want to scare off any of the teams by being too crazy. Here are things being considered. Fractional points to prevent ties. Add a wide receiver slot, so you must start three. Go to PPR or half PPR. But he's open to any great ideas. Thanks. So I think you can go in two directions here. You can incentivize with prizes, or you can incentivize in the opposite way and just destroy the person who gets last place. Like have them take the SATs after a night of drinking or force them to have to root for the Rams for an entire season or something. But realistically, of the things that you mentioned, you need to most definitely go to fractional scoring. Not having fractional scoring is like opting to watch a DVD when you have Netflix. Like, dude, it's 2017. We have self-driving cars and your league doesn't have fractional scoring? Come on. You're better than this. I also don't think that it can hurt to have more flex spots or maybe even a super flex spot to really make things different and unique and make these owners think a little bit more. But the bottom line is that a good league starts and ends with the owners themselves. They need to be into it, and that'll change everything. That'll do it for the questions this week, guys. If you have any questions that you want to ask for next week's mailbag, feel free to hit me up on Twitter at LateRoundQB or email me at jj@numberfire.com. And as always, remember to subscribe to the show by searching for the Late Round Podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play. Thanks for listening, guys. I'll catch you next week.